This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In polite society, most of us don't regard 17-year-olds as adults. They're still teenagers, children. But in North Carolina, if a 16 or 17-year-old is accused of committing a crime, they are tried in the adult criminal justice system. And if convicted, they serve time with adults. Nearly 10,000 young people around the country are locked in adult jails or prisons nearly every day. Reginald Dwayne Betts thinks this is the wrong approach. He believes that because he experienced it firsthand. He was an honor student, but at the age of 16, he was convicted of carjacking and sentenced to 9 years in an adult prison. He served some of that time in solitary confinement. Today, Mr. Betts is a graduate of Yale Law School and the author of A Question of Freedom, which tells his story. He is also in Charlotte to tell his story tonight at the Knight Theater at Levine Center for the Arts on behalf of the Council for Children's Rights, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You were, as I said, an honor student, and yet you were involved in what you have called an egregious error, a carjacking. How did that happen? How did an honor student end up hijacking an automobile?
I don't know. I think I've struggled with that probably for the better part of my life at this point. And I've struggled with it for two reasons. First, I kind of bristle a little bit when I hear people describe me as an honor student, because I recognize that for most of them, it's a way in which they can say, you weren't like those bad 16, 17-year-olds who we might have expected to do this. And I think the reality is what drove me to do it is close to what drives anybody who's 16 and 17, who comes up in a dangerous community, who doesn't have the wherewithal to recognize how damaging a single event could be on their life. And I think what that thing is, basically, is that what is in the realm of opportunity, what is in the realm of possibility for you becomes one of the things that you might gravitate towards. And so for me, I knew people who were committing crimes. I was in a community where it's not as if we thought crime was right, but it was regular. It was something that I just for a minute thought I could get involved with, but now it's shaping the rest of my life. And that sounds like an excuse, and in fact, I get it. It's hard to talk about these things without in some way trying to excuse negative behavior. But I'm not trying to make an excuse. You want to know how it happened, and I recount my life, and I say, these are all the things that happened to me as a child that as a father, I make sure that my son isn't exposed to in any way. And then I take it to the further point and say, sometimes it's not even about being exposed to something, but it's about being exposed to something and not having the conversations and not having the engagement with young people that allows them to navigate the tragedies that, mark their trail.
This is something that a typical young person, a child, doesn't think about. And 16-year-old, you're still a child. You may be a teenager, you may be as tall as a grown man, but you're still a child. And your brain is not fully developed until you're about 27 years old, we are told now. But this is 30 minutes out of your life that literally, as you say, changed your entire life. Had you ever been in trouble before?
No. I mean, I've been in trouble in school. I got suspended a few times, but I'd never been arrested, never been a suspect for a crime, never been interrogated. I've been away from home for 5 days once because I went to a basketball camp. But outside of that, I'd never been away from home for more than 5 days. So it was in every sense of the world, in every sense of the word, and in every sense of the world, a life-altering experience.
Yeah. You grew up, I grew up in Alexandria, and you grew up in the D.C. suburbs of Suitland, Maryland, and went to Springfield Mall in the D.C. suburbs of Virginia, where you committed this crime with your friend Brandon, specifically looking, you say, for someone to make a victim. Can you explain?
Yeah, I would say my friend Marcus, actually.
I'm sorry.
I used a fake name in the...
Okay.
So I used a fake name in the book, but it's funny. I wrote the book and I changed everybody's name. But since then, my friend Marcus Bullock, he was my co-defendant. When I got married, he was the best man at my wedding. my oldest son's godfather. When he got married, I was his best man. I'm his oldest son's godfather. And I think, you know, part of this narrative that we tell really is that when we were 15 and 16, we made a tragic mistake. And we did. We went out to make somebody a victim. And what that means, I think, and why I wrote it that way is because I didn't want to write a book in which I was shying away from the fact that I did something wrong. I didn't want to write a book in which I was trying to pretend that this was some kind of accident. I wanted to write a book where I admitted that I did something that I think is foul. And yet I wanted the book to still try to not necessarily redeem me from that mistake, but say that, you know, I was, as a 15, 16-year-old, all of us as a human, I think capable of a kind of redemption.
Well, let's go back to your 16-year-old brain. Is that what you were thinking when you went to Springfield Mall? Were you thinking, we're going to go here? Marcus and I are going to go in here. We're going to rob some stores. We're going to rob some people. We're going to make people victims. Or was this just a way to get stuff and to have a good time? What was going through your head?
You know, I mean, I honestly was 16, but I don't think necessarily that I was naive. And so, you know, it wasn't as if I thought that I could separate what it meant to commit a crime, what it meant for somebody else who had been a victim of crime, from the desire to get stuff.
Okay.
But if you would have asked me, would this person get hurt or all these other things? Of course, there was no intention to, like, hurt the person, and the person didn't get physically hurt.
Right.
But I don't think we were naive. You know, I think we were motivated by the need to get stuff, but I don't want to come off as thinking that, you know, we were in no way naive. I think I was even smarter at 16. I just really didn't think deeply about what was going on.
I got to tell you, of course, you're 16 years old, and I grew up in that area. You could have picked a better mall. You also had a gun. You also had a gun with you. Where did the gun come from? How long? Where did you get it? How long had you had it?
It was just a friend's gun. It wasn't even a friend's gun. I should say it was like a family member of a friend. And that gets into a longer, complex conversation about, like, influences.
Mm-hmm.
And also about how a chance meeting with somebody else could change your life. I don't even remember the guy's name. So,
you mean the victim's
I
name?
I have a good answer for that.
Okay.
I don't even remember the person's name who I got the gun from.
Okay. You told you had a conversation like this with NPR's Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and you said to her, I think people know if they have any intention of shooting somebody, and the gun I had was on safety, and I didn't even know how to operate the gun. Now, my first thought when I heard that was, then why carry it? But that speaks to the mind of a 16-year-old who's going to go out there and get stuff and maybe get a car in the process. When you think back on that with your adult brain, what do you think about that? Why were you carrying a gun that you didn't know how to use and had no intention of using?
Yeah, but I also think the truth is always more complicated, and it's more complicated than it comes out in a book. And it's usually more complicated than you could ever express on a radio station. And part of that is because, you know, my life is not just my life. It's intertwined with the lives of so many other people. And the truth is sometimes both, you know, an expression of a complete lack of responsibility and something that's actually mundane. And the mundane part of this is just that I literally probably held the gun in my hand for 30 minutes. And if the gun didn't belong to me and somebody gave it to me and they made sure that it wouldn't fire and they knew that I didn't know how to use it. And if you backtrack and you sort of try to go into a more complex conversation and say, well, where does my fault lie when there was somebody else involved? I mean, then for me, it's like, listen, I don't want to assess that question because I'm not interested in trying to duck responsibility. But as somebody who went to law school and as somebody who works as a defense attorney right now and as somebody who represents young people, I'm always asking that question. I'm trying to figure out what is the narrative and the story behind the story that we have here. Mm-hmm. And I know that for all kinds of complex reasons, people don't feel comfortable really exposing every single thing that happened. And so with my situation, like, I have never felt comfortable exposing every single thing that happened. And one of the reasons is that some of the things that have never come up, they point the finger at others. And they show in ways, I think, probably where I'm even arguably less culpable than it appears from anything I've written or said. But again, I'm not like invested in trying to make excuses.
Right.
But the gun situation is a perfect example. You know, I never held a gun before, never fired a gun. The gun was on safety. But that doesn't mean that I might not have, in another world, figured out how to take the gun off safety and accidentally murdered somebody, right? So I'm not trying to pretend like that wasn't a possibility.
And you say in the book that it doesn't, even if you weren't going to use it, and even though you did not, in fact, use it, and you did not take the safety off the gun, that does not negate the fear that the victim felt as you pointed it at his forehead through a car window that you were trying to carjack. And it doesn't make up for the lack of empathy that you showed that man in that moment. Is that just an example of rash thinking or lack of thought among young people who are 16 and haven't had their brain fully developed? Is it an argument for different treatment for 16-year-olds who commit these kinds of crimes?
I think I like to think that my life and the life of others is the better argument for different treatment. And I think that we need different treatment definitely for people who are 16. I don't think people who are 16 should go to prison with adults, but I also don't think adults are 18-year-old or 19-year-old. You know, I've had clients who were 18 and they were like 3 months past their 18th birthday. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if their brains were so fully developed that at 18 they understood the true ramifications of what they were doing. So for me, yes, that's an argument for why a 16-year-old should be in prison. Yeah. That's not to say that's an argument. And people always mistake this. I'm not saying that that's an argument for why a 16-year-old shouldn't be held culpable for the crimes that they commit. I'm saying that we have to recognize that when we are weighing culpability and when we are thinking about the permanent collateral consequences of a felony conviction, when we are thinking about the dangers that exist in prison, when we are thinking about the different aims of prison, the different goals, the different things that prisons are about compared to a juvenile system, I think that we have to be far more mindful about who we send where. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be in a situation where I'm suggesting that because I was 16, I was deserving and worthy of mercy. But had I been 25 or 30, I wasn't. I understand it's a spectrum and we treat people differently based on their age and maturity. But I think that there is a better way to deal with a broad spectrum of these crimes. And it's a better way to think about violence, because I concede that my crime was violent, but I do think that there's something like qualitatively different from what I did to what might have happened if I had shot the guy.
We have about a minute left in this segment, and I want to point out that in your book, A Question of Freedom, A Memoir of Learning, Survival, and Coming of Age in Prison, you're very careful to be culpable. You take responsibility for what you did that night. You are not being apologetic in terms of, well, I shouldn't have done it. You're just saying, I did it. This is what I did. This is what happened to me as a result of having done it. Do most people in 30 seconds or less who you were with in prison, do they take responsibility for what they did?
A lot of people do. I would probably say that most people do, but it always depends on the situation in which you're writing and speaking. And I wrote my book as a 27-year-old man who had a beautiful woman and we were about to have a baby. And my book was an explanation in some ways of my life to my unborn child. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that explanation to include a bunch of excuses.
Dwayne Betts is with us. He's the author of A Question of Freedom. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Library's Get Ready with Words, encouraging success in young children through vocabulary building. Parents and caregivers can teach a child words of the week at getreadywithwords.org. This is shaping up to be a busy year for the transit system here in Charlotte. The next section of the Blue Line, the light rail line to the university area, is about to open. Construction will soon begin on the new phase of the streetcar line, and transit officials are forging ahead with ambitious plans for additional rail lines to the airport, Matthews, and Mooresville, possibly all at once. We hear from the CEO of CATS in an encore conversation tomorrow morning at 9 here on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump's strong statements on trade and immigration are straining the U.S. relationship with Mexico. We'll hear reaction from our southern neighbor. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join the conversation on Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Duane Betts, who at the age of 16 was involved in a carjacking in the state of Virginia. Had he committed that crime as an adult, he would have gotten life in prison, but he got 9 years, served eight, a year and a half of it in solitary confinement, which we'll talk about, and he served that time among adults because he was tried in the adult courts, because the prosecutor made that decision, and he served time in the adult prisons. Most people who commit crimes, like the one you committed, which was a carjacking in which no one was hurt, they have no empathy for the people they're victimizing. And in the moment, you didn't either. So how do you explain that lack of empathy, that complete coldness where you scare someone to their wit's end and could possibly have hurt them? How do you explain that lack of empathy?
I don't, actually. I'm not a huge fan of empathy anyway. I think empathy only gets us so far. And what I point to is that what I think about is at the time I just didn't understand. I didn't fully understand the dimensions of violence. I didn't fully understand the ramifications of any given act. And I hadn't been placed in a situation really where I had to think about it. So I'm not sure, I'm not sure if I would try to explain that lack of empathy. I do think I am more empathetic now, but I also think that I have had opportunity. Prison actually was the most diverse place I'd ever been to, before coming home and being able to go to college and do these different things. And I think, honestly, I didn't come up thinking about empathy in that way. I didn't come up thinking about how any given act I did had an impact on others. I just didn't. It just wasn't a part of my psyche. And in fact, it's interesting because I thought it was in some ways inescapable, as if, and this is just for me, I'm not trying to speak broadly for people in my community. I'm not trying to be a voice of a generation. I'm saying for me specifically, I felt like I was lost.
But let's talk about this, because your mother, you came from you didn't have a father in your life, but you did have a mother who worked very hard to support you. You were an honor student. You never got a grade below a B in high school. Obviously, you had people who cared about you. You were not stealing this car or the other stuff because you were hungry and didn't have clothing, and you were just having a good time doing this. Is that right, essentially?
I mean, it only happened once, so.
But you weren't doing it because you needed this stuff. You did it because you wanted to do it.
Right, right. No, I did because I wanted to do it, but I also did it because I wasn't doing something else.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to say where does the lack of empathy come from, I think, I don't know an answer to that, but if you want to say how do you get to the point where you're doing this, it's because I wasn't doing something else.
So you were tried. You were. You were.
Things that I could have been doing.
You were tried in Virginia, where, as I said, if you'd been an adult, you would have received a life sentence, and the prosecutor was allowed to make the decision about where to try you, in the juvenile court system or the adult court system. They decided the adult court system. Why do we try children, 16-year-old kids, in the adult system and then put them in an adult prison? Why do we do that?
In my case, the prosecutor didn't know me. He didn't try to know me, and they have reasons, legal reasons, why once you get into the adult system, the prosecutor doesn't have an opportunity to talk to you. But he could have talked to people around me. He could have talked to my teachers, my family members. I mean, he could have tried to get a sense of who I was before he made a decision that would expose me to a life sentence. He made the decision just based on the fact that he thought it was no explanation, I guess, for what he perceived as a lack of empathy, for what he perceived as apparent coldness and a willingness to pull a gun out on somebody and irrevocably change their life. And in some ways, in some ways, maybe. I understand it, except I know that there are better courses of action, and I know that he operated with a total lack of information. It didn't matter if there was anything about me that suggested that I would go on to graduate from college, that I would go on to mentor young people, that I would go on to, graduate from Yale Law School. None of those things mattered. It wasn't on the agenda to think about what was possible in my life going forward. It didn't even matter if there was something that I could do to make amends in the immediate moment of the life of the victim in the community that I harmed. I mean, in fact, I don't think that my 9 years, 8.5 years in prison did anything to repair the trust that was broken and the damage that was done on December 7th, 1996. I could imagine my victim listening to this now wondering why I get the opportunity to speak about my life and he doesn't have a comparative opportunity. And there's all kinds of reasons why that's true, but none of those reasons will matter if we had a system that imagined that him becoming whole was about more than me going to prison.
Wow. You were a smart guy. And still are, obviously, but you were a smart guy at 16 because you were an honor roll student. And on the night of the arrest, you may have been smart, but you were also naive. I mean, you were 16 years old. You read your Miranda rights, but in spite of that, you talked to police. Why?
Everybody talked to police.
But, I mean, you actually said, yeah, I kind of did this, and I'm guilty, why would you do that? I mean, everybody watches television, and they know not to do that.
I don't know, though. I mean, no, honestly, I think everybody talks to police. I think the majority of people in prison talk to police. I think that one of the ways in which we think about people who commit crimes is these people who are wily and out to defeat the system, and sometimes the people who commit crimes are just basically desperate. Mm. And sometimes getting caught is a chance to just breathe.
Wow.
And to just say, you know what, I did it. And listen, I was an honor student and I was smart, but I still felt like I was in a situation at home, in school, in my community, where I just couldn't get around things.
Why? You said earlier in this conversation that you felt lost. Why?
Well, it was a couple of things. You know, you got to think about what it means to be. I was the first person in my family to go to prison and the first person to go to college. It is a point, I think, in the lives of some people where the idea that you could do things like go to college and be successful becomes a certain kind of pressure because you don't see it and nobody really engages with those opportunities. And I remember it was three people that got killed, at least three people in my high school class that got killed. One young girl got killed by two of my classmates, and they got tried as adults. And we still didn't have a conversation about the fact that they were going to prison and ultimately went to prison. One of my classmates was murdered in the street by another guy that I knew. He went to prison. Somebody else went to prison. I mean, it was this profound sense of tragedy that was going on and a profound amount of trauma. And look, everybody in my school, all of them didn't do what I did. A lot of my classmates went on to go to college. So I'm not even saying that this is an excuse, but if you want the sort of broader picture of the world that I was coming up in, it's somebody who was dealing with trauma, somebody who was dealing with tragedy, somebody who was smoking too much weed, and I just did not have a wherewithal to see through it. And although I expected to go to college, I wanted to go to college, it's not as if somebody was mentoring me. If somebody was saying, listen, you're in 11th grade, you should be thinking about college essays. If somebody was saying, I know that Charles got killed, but listen, you can see past this, right? So I think what I mean by saying that I was lost is if I reflect upon that time and just think about the reality, it was a lot of stuff that was going on. And I was always talked about as if I was smart, right? And the one in my community who would end up going to college, while the rest of the people who I grew up with, though, who I had sleepovers with, they were expected to end up locked up. And I think that is a tremendous burden for anybody to carry. And again, it doesn't excuse the crime,
yeah.
But if I'm trying to have a serious conversation about where I was at 16, it would have to include those things.
On the night that you were arrested, just to give people an understanding of who you are and what you were like at 16, you were 5'5", weighed 120 pounds, and had braces on your teeth. which they removed before your prison sentence began because they don't have good dental care in prisons. And you write that you were so slight that the handcuffs almost slid off your wrist. But you also write that as you sat in the back of the police car, your thoughts raced through all of the prison movies that you'd seen and of the violence that was potentially awaiting you in jail and in prison. Is that what you found to be true in jail and in prison?
Yes and no. I think I was raised in prison, so I would argue I'm a good father. I would argue that I'm at least a decent husband. I would argue that I'm generally a good man, good human being, care about people. And the things that make me that, to be frank, I got a lot of it in prison. I went to prison at 16, came home at 24. The kind of questions that determine who I wanted to be in the world were first asked of me in prison. So that's true. The violence is also true. I mean, somebody was murdered in a cell above me, you know. I've seen people stabbed. I've seen people had their hair split open with locks. So, yes, the violence was also true. And was wild, really, thinking about that time period, is that I had read so many of those books before I went to prison, as if, as if I was, like, preparing myself for knowing it, you know. Because I read books that nobody had read. The Alba Semple story. I mean, people don't even know who this guy is. And I read a book about him. I read Man Child in the Promised Land. I read Makes Me Want to Holler. And one of the things I do say in the book, one of the things I struggle with is, why is it that I have read these books? And I've seen Shawshank Redemption. I've seen American Me. I've seen these movies and read these books, and yet they weren't enough to make me understand how foolish it would be to commit a crime like this. I knew people who had committed carjackings, and it wasn't enough to watch what happened as a result of those crimes. So I often think about that. And I think the conclusion I come to, really, and this is why I return to prison to talk to people, this is why I return to public schools to talk to people, is that it's more than about just knowing something. If you really want to engender empathy, if you really want to help create understanding, you have to talk to people. You can't expect people to just sort of consume this information on their own and get it, because I didn't get it. You know, I had the crime that occurred the week before in my neighborhood in my head with Things Fall Apart to end with Evelyn Woods, speed reading. You know, I had this jumble of desires and ideas and ambition in my head rattling about trying to create somebody. And unfortunately, when it all played out, what grabbed hold of me, even if only for 30 minutes, was the thing that landed me in prison.
Wow. Dwayne Betts is our guest. His book is called A Question of Freedom, and he's here to talk about this at A Night for Children's Rights, featuring Dwayne Betts, tonight between 6:15 and 7:45 at the Knight Theater. There may be tickets available for that remaining, and you can find out at WFAE.org. Bob Simmons is here. He's been sitting here listening to this conversation. He's executive director of the Council for Children's Rights, which is a nonprofit agency here in Charlotte, providing legal representation and advocacy for children. And he also serves as a member of the leadership team of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
You have said that Dwayne's experience closely aligns with those of the children that you serve in this area. What do you mean by that?
Well, because North Carolina is one of the two states that continues to treat all 16 and 17-year-olds as adults for all criminal purposes, we actually would not have represented Dwayne in the situation where he was involved. Our jurisdiction ends at 15. We are the public defender in Mecklenburg County under contract with the Indigent Defense Services of the Administrative Office of the Courts of North Carolina to represent all children who are charged in cases involving juvenile delinquency.
Do you still think that, although you stop at 15 because of North Carolina law, do you think that 16 and 17-year-olds, even 18-year-olds, it can be argued that they are children?
Yes. I don't think there's any question, as you mentioned at the beginning of our talk today, that the brain science shows that the ability to control impulses, the ability to understand the consequences.
Or even that there are consequences in some cases.
Yes. Yes, that does not exist. There's a group called the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice, which issued a recommendation back in November of last year that North Carolina raise the age of juvenile court jurisdiction. The maximum age is now 15 to 17, mm-hmm. so that 16 and 17-year-olds would be covered by the juvenile law rather than the adult law. And we favor that because we believe that that's a good step in the right direction, but it doesn't quite go as far as we'd want, but we need to make the progress we can.
About 250,000 people nationwide, young people nationwide, are prosecuted in the adult criminal justice system every year. Why do we take that approach, and how long has it been going on?
Well, in North Carolina, the law was adopted in 1919, and I can't speak to how long the 16, 17-year-olds, others, have been treated as adults in other jurisdictions, and there are a variety of different ways that this is treated across the country. Connecticut, where Duane is a public defender, actually has the most advanced age. They're looking at raising it even to 21. So it's one of those things that has existed, and I think it's because we have a mixture of approaches to offenses that are undertaken or committed by young people. On one side, we understand that they are young people, and we understand that they should be treated in a way that recognizes their incapacity. But on the other side, we also have this concern about public safety, and I think that often those two compete with one another, and that people who are more interested in the punitive side of it are more likely to say that we should treat young people as adults.
And yet he mentioned that he felt lost. He's an honor student in Suitland, Maryland, in 11th grade. He felt lost, didn't really have anybody saying, at this stage of your life, you should be thinking about writing your college essay and which college you might want to go to, because he was certainly on the college track. Is that common, particularly in poorer neighborhoods where most of the kids probably don't go to college? Is it common for them not to get the guidance that they need from professionals? And you used to be on the school board here a long time ago. Is that common?
I think that there really is a gap between wealthier and less wealthy parts of every community where there is less of an opportunity, perhaps, to have some of that instruction and that engagement. But I really do think that we need to focus more on the questions that I think Duane has raised that have to do with what is an effective way of dealing with youthful offenses. Where do they come from? How can we provide young people who may not have access to opportunities to do other things, as Duane mentioned, those opportunities?
And even the judge who sentenced Duane in court told him from the bench that he had no illusions that sending him to prison would help him, but that maybe you can get something out of this. When we come back from the break, we'll find out if Duane feels that he did, in fact, get something out of this. Not that it excuses anything, but we'll just find that out when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. President Trump's comments on immigration and trade have put a strain on the U.S. relationship with Mexico. Coming up in 20 minutes on Point Reaction about to those statements from south of the border. And a reminder that WFAE and Charlotte Talks are holding a public conversation tomorrow night at 7, discussing immigration policy, enforcement, and immigration's impact here in the Charlotte area. It's at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, a two-hour public conversation from the McGlowan Theater in Uptown. Free registration at WFAE.org.
The story of President Trump's first 100 days is unfolding across the country.
These sorts of things that are happening right now, we have to stand up. And if we don't stand up, then it normalizes.
He's got the right idea. We've got to put our country first, not just on the pro-life issue, but with everything. We've got to get jobs back into the country.
You can count on NPR News to follow how decisions in Washington play out at home. Listen every day.
Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Simmons is sitting in our Spirit Square studio. He's the executive director of the Council for Children's Rights and joining us by phone in advance of his appearance tonight in Charlotte at the Knight Theater is Duane Betts, the author of A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning, survival, and coming of age in prison, where he went approximately at the age of 16 and spent until 24 there, part of his time in solitary confinement. And the judge said at the sentencing, he had no illusions of sending you to prison that it would help you, but that you could maybe could get something out of it. How did that comment, coming from the judge, if you even remember how you felt, how did it feel when he said it to you in the courtroom, and did you, in fact, get something out of it?
Instead of saying how I felt, I should say how my family felt. My aunt started screaming, and it was as if it was a feral cat in an alley, you know, being attacked. And I remember turning around, telling her that I'll be fine. I'll be okay. How did I feel when a judge said that? I never forgot that he said that. I carried it around with me for more than a decade before I actually got my transcript and confirmed. And in fact, he did say that. I just remembered it. I always remembered it, even with everything else that was going on. I never forgot that. And I never forgot it because I thought it was absurd, because I recognized I was terrified. You know, I was 5'5", 120 pounds, and a jail is a dangerous place. And the thing is, sometimes the dangers you imagine far exceed any that you actually face, but the dangers that you imagine can change your life forever. So, you know, on one hand, I appreciate his honesty in that moment, and I appreciate his attempt to maybe be, what, empathetic. But at the other hand, on the other hand, I recognize that it showed a profound lack of understanding, as if he couldn't have did something else, as if he couldn't have requested more information, even in a sort of imperfect system that we have. He could have requested more information.
Well, I don't know what the laws in the laws in the state of Virginia are, but sometimes judges' hands are tied. They have to.
I can tell you the laws in Virginia. I mean, look, I had a mandatory minimum sentence. I mean, I didn't have a mandatory minimum sentence. Carjacking carries life, carries a maximum of life. It carries a minimum of 15. Robbery carries 5 to 40. I was sentenced to, and then a gun charge is 3 years mandatory. So I had a minimum sentence of 23 years, of which 3 was mandatory. But everything outside of that 3 could have been suspended. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he could have did a blended sentence in which some of my time was meant to be served in the juvenile justice, juvenile detention center. And if I did well, then all of my time would have been served there. But he could have, even in an adult system, he could have sentenced me to as little as 3 years. And so I think this whole idea that judges' hands are tied is one of the excuses that we give people. And again, it's the judge, it's the prosecutor, it's all of us. You know, we all played a role in this, and not just in my life, but in every life. So we play this role in an imperfect system in which we intentionally refuse to get more information. Because if he tells me that he's under no illusion that sending me to prison will help, he should at least have enough information about me where he's making a true assessment of what he thinks I might be.
So, Bob,
the fact that I ended up being.
I'm sorry. So Bob Simmons, it sounds a little cynical that the judge would say, I don't think he's going to help you, but I'm going to send you there anyway. Is that an argument for changing sentencing, for changing the way we do this? I mean, you have said that the juvenile justice system is fairer and it's more effective.
It is. It is both. I mean, because one of the things that happens in the juvenile justice system is that that judge would be provided with the information that Duane says his judge was not provided with. That's part of our role. We provide information about the entire life of the child, including their family, their neighborhood, the background to their offense, their school environment, so that we can inform the judge and he can then fulfill the rehabilitative role of juvenile court, which is to provide the services that are necessary in order to help that child overcome the obstacle that they've created for themselves by making a mistake so they can then realize their potential. So it really makes a huge difference.
And we have this young guy, Duane, 5'5", 120 pounds, 16 years old, is put in Gen Pop with hardened criminals and dangerous people. And even if he was sentenced for the full 24 years, which he was not, he got 9 and I think he got out in 8, he's still going to get out. There are all these young people in prison who are going to get out. prison doesn't really prepare you for very much, except going to prison.
Right, and I think,
go ahead.
I think that is, I mean, honestly, when I look back at it, if you ask me why I think it was profoundly wrong, it's just that it was always this realization that I was coming home. And nobody asked, nobody cared, what prison will you be sent to? It's a documentary out right now on Red Onion State Prison, maximum security prison in Virginia.
I saw it.
I was there when I was 18. I was in solitary confinement there. And so, you know, it is just, I mean, again, I came out fine. And in fact, I probably came out better for it.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because a lot of guys go in there like you, and although you were an honor student going in, all that was tossed out the window. You got your GED in prison.
That's what I'm
But then, when you got out, you went to community college. You went to the University of Maryland. You went to some other location. And then you went to Yale Law School. You're now a lawyer. Not many people do that. How did this happen? You've written two books. How did you had a poem published while you were in prison. Why you?
Yeah, two things. One of the reasons why I appreciate coming back to North Carolina is actually I got my MFA degree from Warren Wilson College in North Carolina. So for a couple of years, North Carolina was like home.
Mm-hmm.
Was like home to me. But I think in some ways I was fortunate. You know, I met some good people. I was also literate, and I also couldn't fight, right? And I think although that's a huge detriment in prison, sometimes your weaknesses force you to develop different strengths. And I've talked a lot as I do now. But going in prison, I might have veered towards cruelty more in terms of how I talk to people, how I made fun of people. And prison was such a desperate situation that I had to learn how to be a better communicator, a better person. And so I think I developed some skills that have served me well once I got out of prison. But again, I was just fortunate. You know, I was fortunate. I was able to deal with solitary confinement. You can't predict somehow how being locked in a cage will impact somebody.
So,
and for me, I was actually able to deal with it.
So society is better for having Dwayne Betts in it. It can be argued, I think. And he was lucky enough to turn his life around and become a contributing member of society. But as we were trying to say a minute ago, a lot of kids who go into prison get out. They're not prepared to do what Dwayne Betts has done with his life. Is that another argument for changing the way we do things and putting more young people into juvenile justice situations for corrective behavior? Because are they, those who go into those situations, are they better equipped to handle civilian life when they come out?
Well, and I think, Mike, that one of the things that's important for people to understand is that when we treat children or youth as children and youth and provide them with the kind of services that they need in order to deal with the source of the problems that they've created for themselves, that we are more likely to have a safer society, a more productive society. We're likely to have to avoid the costs of continued incarceration, as you've said. We have lower recidivism rates. There are fewer new offenses committed by juveniles who are treated in juvenile court than there are in adult court.
Yeah.
So that makes a big difference, actually, for public safety.
And there are two state studies in North Carolina that you've referred to, or at least I read about yesterday. I can't remember whether you referred to them or not. But there are two state studies that have estimated that the cost savings to the state of raising the age of juvenile court jurisdiction just to 18 would be as high as $52 million. Has that spurred any movement in that direction?
Well, I think that the cost savings in the long run are a very positive part of the argument for raising the age. But you have to overcome the cost increase in the short run, which would involve moving the kids into juvenile court, raising the ability of juvenile court to handle the volume. Because we're looking at close to 6,000 kids in the, I think it was 2014, statistics that were reported, who were treated as adults in North Carolina who would be coming into the juvenile system. 80% of those were misdemeanors. Another 16% of those were lower-level offenses. And the recommendation that's going to probably turn into legislation during this session provides for all of those misdemeanors and lower level offenses to be treated in juvenile court rather than adult court, with only the 3.3% of those cases, which are the higher level of felony offenses, to be treated as adults. So there has to be an increase in the amount of money that's put into the system to start with, in addition to providing the services that would have to be required for these kids. But in the long run, that's an investment. We have to look at it as an investment in the long-term value for our state. And it's also the right thing to do. You know, the argument about the money is a good argument, and it's important for us to be able to make that part of our public policy. Mm-hmm. But we also have to look at what is the right thing to do to help our young people develop in a way that is likely to result in their success, to restore to them their childhoods, to restore to them their potential and their hope by helping them with the right services.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we only have about 6.5 minutes left here, Duane, but I do want to talk about it a little bit, and that is the fact that you spent about a year and a half of your 9 years or 8 years in prison in solitary confinement, and you referred to the Red Onion State Prison in Virginia, which is a subject of a documentary where a lot of that solitary confinement takes place. What did you do to justify solitary confinement, and what does that do to a person?
I did nothing, actually. I think I'm grown and I'm past the need to, like, lie and mask anything that I did. And I feel like I admitted to carjacking somebody and pulling out a gun on somebody. So I hope people believe me when I say that I literally did nothing to be placed in the hole. The first time I was sent to the hole, I touched the guard's arm to say, you know what, officer, I was just trying to get a suspension. I moved to the cell. And they slammed me on the ground and said, I saw them. The second time, I didn't let a guard shut me in the cell because I was wrong for that, but I was upset. But I didn't, like, assault the person. I got charged with assault for that. And then last time, a guard was searching me and grabbed my genitals, and I took his hands off of me, and I got charged with assault for that. And so I spent, you know, over, like...
And what does that do to you? What does a year and a half in solitary do to you?
Yeah, I mean, it breaks a lot of people. It breaks a lot of people. I mean, it forces you to find something inside yourself that'll sustain you or get ruined by it. It changes the way you think about time. It changes the stories you tell yourself. It's actually hard to describe.
And it was in solitary, however, that where you can have nothing. There's no stimulation of any kind. I mean, there's no television. There's no books allowed, although books do float through solitary somehow, and that changed your life because somebody slipped a book under your cell door, Dudley Randall's The Black Poets, and that literally, and people can read the book to figure out why it changed your life, but it did. You got out of prison. Many guys who get out of prison can't get a job because they are an ex-con, which leaves them no options except a life of crime to go back to prison. You went to college. You went to Yale Law School. You became an attorney. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I wish I had easy answers. I mean, of course, I've always loved books, and I think books are a conduit to success. I think education is a conduit to success. And honestly, I came home and I was 24 and I probably looked like I was 21. And so it was easier for me to go to college and acclimate myself to that environment. I mean, I love books and honestly, like, the university is one of the few places where prison and a criminal record is not the same type of stigma. And you get an opportunity to prove yourself. You get an opportunity to show people what your worth is and what your value is, and how you can move around and within that space and be an asset to your classmates and your professors and the rest of your peers. And so, you know, had I decided to do something else, I think it might not have panned out as well for me. But because I went to school, I was just able to transition and build an entire life for myself around books and around knowledge and around education. And then I started doing advocacy work, and I became interested in going to law school, and I was able to apply to law school. And again, I might not get a job right now if I applied to McDonald's because I have a criminal record, but I was able to get in Yale Law School. And what that speaks to is the different intentions of one institution as opposed to another. McDonald's would just look at the fact that I have a criminal record and say no. Well, Yale Law School looks at me as a whole person and says, well, what else do you have? And it's not just Yale. I went there, but I also got into Columbia. I got into Harvard. I got in the University of Pennsylvania. I got in the University of Michigan. I got in the Georgetown. And I don't say those things to brag. I say those things to say that, look, you dealing with a 16-year-old who has committed a tragic crime, right? And you look at him and you expect that he will amount to nothing. And that's the reason why so many young people don't amount to anything, because that's what we expect of them. If we looked at him and said, these are the realm of possibilities. They might go to college. They might go to Lincoln Tech. They might become a mechanic. If we put something in front of them that allows them to grasp that potential, and that is far more valuable to society than all of the broken men who leave out of prison.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who are broken by prison. I know a lot of people who weren't as well, but I know a lot of people who were broken, who shouldn't have been broken, and who could be assets to society.
I have 30 seconds left, Wayne. And your father spent time in prison. You spent time in prison. You had a life and a mother who cared about you. You were on the college track in high school. You have children. What do you tell them about that part of your life, and how do you keep them on the straight and narrow in 30 seconds?
Yeah, in 30 seconds, honestly, my peers, classmates, my professors, white people, society that I deal with, and people of other cultures who don't have the kind of history of prison, they don't even have to ask themselves that question. So I move in the world like them. I teach my sons what they need to know in terms of what the world looks like, but I put the same opportunities in front of them that my professors put in front of their children. And if for any reason we end up living in the community that I lived in, I will make sure that they recognize what it means to live in that community, and that they are agitating and advocating to change that community instead of accepting what's given to us, because far too often we just can't accept what is given.
Dwayne Betts, author of A Question of Freedom, Bob Simmons, executive director of the Council for Children's Rights. Thanks.